good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Writer's Block with me, Morgan O'Reilly, right here on 90.3 Near FM. Punctured bicycle on a hillside, that's over. Coming up today, we've got all the best in music interviews and, of course, all things literary, so stick around. When in this charming car, this charming man, why pamper the life's complexity when the leather runs smooth on the passenger seat? Yes, of course, why pamper life's complexities when the leather runs smooth on the passenger seat? Why indeed, Morrissey, why indeed? Well, we've got a great show coming up for you today, folks. We have Oran and Shannon from Flying South, a poetry open mic night in Stony Batter. We have, after 4 o'clock, also our usual visiting writer slot, and Daniel Wade is going to be coming in to chat to us, so looking forward to that one too. First, we will be taking a bit of music now, something cool to cool us all off from the sweltering heat outside. I heard this one time off some kind of musicologist or some kind of music academic or something like that. He said, and this is a paraphrase anyway, he said that you can characterise African music by two things: the music that came before Sly and the Family Stone and the music that came after Sly and the Family Stone. So you can make that of what you will, and enjoy this one. Now it is Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again. Yeah, Sly and the Family Stone there. Well, I am very pleased to welcome to the studio now Shannon and Oran from Flying South. Guys, you're very welcome. Thanks for having us. So we'll get the awkward bits out of the way to start. So can you introduce yourselves? Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll move on to Flying South.
Yeah. My name is Oran Morton. I'm a applied psychology student, and got working with Flying South from the beginning, and
you're both founding members.
Yeah, the two of us.
Six of us all together.
Yeah. And Shannon, how about you? What are you doing for yourself?
I just finished my college degree. I was in Maynooth doing Bachelor of Arts, so I was doing English and Sociology, and I just have a thesis now to hand up in August and one exam to do, then I'll be fully finished. My degree.
How's the thesis going?
It's not going too bad now. I just started, but it's due the 4th of August, so okay. I'm going to have to going to put my head down this month.
Absolutely. So let's get on to Flying South anyway. Yeah. What is it? What's it all about?
Well, it's an open mic event for people to share their experiences of having a mental health issue. They can share their experiences through poetry, song, drama, any way that they feel they want to express it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the basis of what we wanted to do.
Where is it on? Just to give people a frame of reference here.
It's on in Jaja Studios in Stony Batter, so it's a bit difficult to find.
Yeah.
But it's kind of near Houston Station if you walk down Stony Batter. It's just a little bit out of the city, but
It's only like 10 minutes from Smithfield Lewis stop, so it's
grand. Are you Stony Batter natives or from that neck of the woods?
No.
Why was it chosen?
Location was like, because when we started off, it was just running out of our own pockets, so we had literally no money. Mm. And we're looking for places, and Jaja were, they were like, we can do it for free here, and they were just really nice. And
yeah, that's something. Because, I mean, we've had a couple of open mic nights and stuff on the show here. How easy is it to set one up? I mean, can you do it tomorrow? How easy is it to come across funding, these kind of things?
When we started off, it seemed like I never thought I could do anything like this. Mm. But it's easy and hard in that, like, you can just set it up. You can just go and do it. Mm. Like, if you find somewhere to do it and you know the people, you know people like to, if you can MC it and whatever. But I think in terms of marketing it and like getting people to know about it and turn up, that's a lot of work. You know, you've got to really put yourself out there.
Yeah, there's like practicalities involved that, like, I'm not good at thinking of the practical things. I kind of just would have an idea in my head.
But idealism only gets you so far.
Yeah.
He's quite good at the practicalities, kind of what needs to be done and what time it needs to be done by, like.
Flying South, what's the inspiration behind the name?
I come up with the name. It was just because I think one of the founders, Trudy, has an obsession with birds, so we had to get birds somewhere in there. But it's sort of, you know, going to a warmer climate, a warm, more hospitable environment, more a nicer place, and in, as well in terms of like a flock, a community. So, yeah, that was the...
And it was originally meant to be in Rathmines, so it kind of took them then flying over to the south side.
Yeah, but then our the location wasn't good, and then...
So we just kept the name anyway.
Yeah, it still works.
Yeah, you'd gotten that far with it.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you mentioned, Shannon, that it's kind of particularly devoted to discussing ideas of mental health. Is that the key difference, I suppose, in your open mic night? Is there anyone else doing that? I mean, because it's a crowded market, let's face it.
I think we're the first now in Dublin and Ireland to be doing an open mic that's completely centred on mental health.
Mm.
And we're kind of trying to set a safe space environment, so maybe people who aren't used to performing... So as opposed to kind of other open mics where people might be familiar with performing, we have this kind of safe space policy where we're just very respectful of whoever's performing, and if they want to perform from where they're sitting down, they can do that. So I think that's kind of what differs with us and other places, that we just have a very respectful and communal kind of atmosphere.
You wouldn't even think of that, people not being comfortable performing. I mean, it's because it is a very... I mean, you're really opening yourself out when you get up to read a poem and stuff.
Yeah.
Is it poetry mostly? Is there a good variety of things that are
poetry
doing?
Poetry and song. And
there's a lot of songs and
maybe
short fiction
short
as well. Yeah, but like I think as well, I think there have been, you know, specific mental health sort of arts events, and you know, maybe there, you know, there probably have been, you know, open mic parts of that or whatever. But
on an ongoing basis.
I think the significant thing is the ongoing basis, because you've got a community that you can come back to, and a place, you know. So I think that's an important difference as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Something like First Fortnight is just January, but you guys are monthly, as you say. Yeah. So you are monthly. How long have you been going?
March. Yeah.
March. That was first show.
Yeah. Yep. So the fifth show will be this month, and it's the last Friday of every month.
Yep. Last Friday. Of every month.
So.
How have you been received so far?
Quite well, to be honest. Like, we've been actually surprised with the amount of people turning up, just considering as well the location of where it is. It's difficult to get to. But we've been shared by different kind of mental health organisations on Facebook and Twitter, so I think that's helped as well.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah.
We've been packed out every month.
Yeah. Really?
So, and like we can fit about 80 people, I think, and it's always been like 70, 80 people, and it's been
that's
really
great.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned there you were being shared by various organisations on Twitter and Facebook and stuff. Is there a nice community there? I mean, particularly there would be a lot of goodwill surrounding mental health, but other arts groups, arts communities.
Yeah, I think it kind of sells itself. Like, we have to sell it. We have to like put ourselves out there. But I think once you put it out there and people hear about it, I think they're really, really drawn to it. I think they see the potential in it, and I think that's something we noticed, that the people wanted it, like people were waiting for something like this, because when we speak to people, they're like, oh yeah, I'm waiting for this, and we spoke to people who came to the events, they're like, I was looking around for something like this, and
that's
lovely.
Tell me about how a normal night pans out. What happens?
Well, we do have three feature acts, so we kind of pre-book three feature acts who would be like well-known performers, poets, and we have one at the beginning, and then we have an open mic slot. So we leave a sign-up sheet just at the door as people come in, and if people want to sign up, they put their name down. Then we have a short interval, about 10 minutes, and then the second feature act, and then more sign-ups, and then we have another interval, and the third feature act and more sign-ups.
Mm-hmm.
So it's three feature acts with sign-ups in between.
Mm-hmm.
And does it depend on the night how many people sign up? I mean,
we've actually generally got like to the end of the night with enough sign-ups. Like sometimes during the night it might not look like there's enough, but then people kind of get courage and decide, I want to put my name down, kind of thing.
Happen,
and we all like write our own poetry as well, so we could step in if
I think that's a significant thing as well, where throughout the night people will be like, will feel like they want to sign up. A lot of people come, they're like, oh no, I don't want to talk, you know, and then, but when they see the sort of nice reception that people get, the respect and the, you know, they feel comfortable. Like, I think every event we've had two or three people that have changed their mind and decided, oh no, I feel like I can talk, so.
And that's, that must be the community aspect of it.
Yeah.
It's really, really nice to see, You just had a show a couple of days ago, Friday the 26th of June. Who was performing? Who was reading?
We had we had a fill-in because one of our feature acts was trapped in Switzerland.
hang on, go back to that.
So we got a ransom. No, we didn't get a ransom.
She was traveling, I think.
Yeah, she was traveling, and she's a journalist as well, so she was traveling. Okay, but she was good. There was like delays in Italy, and
so it wasn't James Bond.
No, there was no James. There was no there's no skiing and parachutes with a Union Jack parachute or whatever. We had Aidan Murphy filled in, which was really cool. And we had Carl Parkinson, we had Byrne, who's a singer-songwriter and a musician. And it was actually really interesting. Carl Parkinson went to the school that's right next door to Jaja Studios, place where we are, it's an old factory. And his mother and sister had worked in the factory that is now the space that we...
It's so really random.
It was really cool.
Okay, well, folks, I'm Morgan O'Reilly on 90.3 Near FM. You're listening to Writer's Block. I've got Shannon and Oren from Flying South with me. We will take a bit of music now, but don't go anywhere, because we've got them coming up after this song now. This is one from the Pogues. It's from their 1985 album, those three great traditions of the Royal Navy, Rum, Sodomy and the Lash. And this one is called The Body of an American. And we are back with Writer's Block with me, Morgan O'Reilly, on 90.3 Near FM. Well, apologies for that slight disc malfunction there. I can honestly swear it wasn't my fault. Oren and Shannon will attest to that, I'm sure.
Yeah. I jumped over and pressed the eject button because I wanted a moment of silence. So,
thanks, Oren. I'll give you that tenor. Later. Okay, getting back to Flying South, I'd like to talk a little more about the mental health issues that you're trying to raise with the whole night. How effective do you think poetry and literature in general, or even other art forms, are kind of an effective form of discussing or even sharing ideas of mental health? I mean, is it positive? Does it muddy the issue a little bit? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it can be, I think it can be good for the person themselves who's, you know, expressing themselves, no matter what the expression is. You know, it can be therapeutic, I think. And as well, if a writer is expressing something that people can, you know, identify with, I think the audience can benefit as well. You know, I think sometimes there can be problematic things in expression, but you know, that you kind of have to, because, you know, is it art or is it, you know, activism or support or social change or whatever? And those lines are a bit blurred sometimes, but I think on balance, it's, you know, it can be very helpful for the artist and the audience.
Absolutely. So it's a kind of a release.
Yeah.
It can be therapeutic for the person. Mm. Can the forum of, let's say, for instance, Flying South, you know, sharing all these ideas in front of a crowd, hearing their reception, hearing them kind of echo similar ideas, is that then also therapeutic?
I think so. Like, I think when someone writes a poem in their own space, like in their own personal space, and then when they share it to a group of people, like, they're very vulnerable on stage, and I think when they get a positive reaction or it resonates with someone else, it creates a mutual kind of feeling of, well, you went through that and I can understand that as well. Because I think especially with mental health, you feel very alone, I think, when you're suffering from a mental illness, and to be able to express it through a poetry and then share it with a group of people, I think, is very beneficial.
Yeah, it really solidifies, you know, what you're saying. Like, if you're expressing some kind of narrative about your mental health issues that tries to frame it, you know, in some way that you can process it, once you express it in front of people, it's a really powerful sort of anchor that ties that positive narrative, you know. So
kind of liberating as well, I think.
Yeah.
Is it liberating as well if you don't share it? I mean...
It can be, I suppose. Like, for a long time, like, I would write stuff and just never perform it out anywhere, just kind of for myself. And like, the first time I did perform was at the first Flying South, and like, for me, it was kind of a big deal, because sometimes I had written so much, it was kind of just going around in my head, and I'd be kind of saying it in my head but never speaking it out loud. And I think to speak something out loud, it does kind of change the meaning of it a bit. It's not just confined to your own mind, kind of thing.
But I think a lot of people who come who don't perform, you know, they still really enjoy and really feel positive about the whole experience as well.
Even just the awareness. I mean, even if it's an extremely difficult poem that gets read out, I mean, it's better to hear it than for everybody to remain ignorant in silence, I suppose. This is a question I've been thinking about for a while, and maybe you guys have the answers. Like, if we look at the history of poetry and literature and all forms of art, again, you could probably argue, you don't have to work very hard to find out, like, numerous examples of writers suffering from depression. I mean, it's a kind of a classic cliche, you know, the depressed writer, possibly and or alcoholic. Why is this? Why do you think writers in particular are susceptible to various forms of emotional well-being or mental health difficulties?
Well, I think, like, the fact that people who can see things in a more creative way, I think it also makes them quite sensitive. Like, I think to see things in a way an artist or a writer or a poet sees things, it's kind of different and it's more broader, and I think that makes them more sensitive to their environment and to their own life circumstances. So I think it can create, like, these wonderful works of art, like poetry or fiction, but to be living with that day to day, to be going around with that kind of massive creative sensitivity, it can kind of, I think that's what might get people down. I think the other side of creativity is sensitivity, I think. And I think that's what affects a lot of writers, is that intense sensitivity that they have to the world around them.
So you need to be sensitive in a sense to produce the art that you draw from the world.
I don't know, I've thought about it a lot, and I don't know if it necessarily is true that artists are more sort of susceptible. I think it's more that, because I think it sort of obfuscates the sort of fact that everybody has, you know, difficulty mental health issues. I think it's just that artists are sort of putting themselves out there. You're not going to say, let's say an accountant, you're not going to be like, I'm looking at these guys' accounts and I can really see that he's suffering with depression. You know, but you see it in a writer because, you know, they really put it into their art. But I think, you know, I think to a certain extent you can understand, like, art is very solitary, you know, especially writing, you know, it's a very solitary sort of task. You're not in an office with, like, you know, a bunch of people, and you can't, you know, you're sort of, your social circle is up to you to maintain. You know, you're not going to meet somebody for lunch, you know, unless you decide to. You're not going to, you know. So I think there's a certain extent that there are things to be aware of, you know.
Is the desire to write the thing that makes them depressed, or is trouble with their mental health the reason that they start writing? For you, for anybody, what do you think?
I think it can be both, I think. You know, I think you can certainly see, and I, you know, in my own experience, you have certain issues that you can't sort of process unless you put them outside yourself onto a page, and you know, it becomes reflexive, where you can go, okay, I can see this from a different perspective. But I think, you know, writing, like I said, is very solitary. I think it's very difficult to, you know, make a living, or, you know, get anywhere with it. You know, it takes a lot of hard work and some luck as well, so that can lead to mental health issues as well. So it can definitely be both.
This is kind of a little fun exercise to draw us out of the deep descent we were falling into there, to kind of illustrate to some of our listeners, like, the profound influence mental health has had on literature to date. I thought it might be fun if each of us picked a writer just off the top of our head, someone that we like, someone that has had an influence on us. And that writer has to have had particular struggles with mental health. So, Shannon, can we go to you?
Well, the writer is just someone I'm reading at the moment, and I'm not too sure of his experience with mental health. His name is Gregory David Roberts, but the book is like an autobiography about his... I suppose he does have mental health issues, it's just not worded in that way, but he, like, escaped from a prison and went to live in India and just had really difficult experiences over there, so it's not set in that dialogue of him having a mental health problem. But, you know, if he went to a psychiatrist, I'm sure they diagnose him with something.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Not actually kind of naming it and categorizing it. And Oren, can we go to you?
J.K. Rowling is someone that I think comes to mind for me, because it's not something you'd think, you know, when you look at her, and she's like a superstar of you know, literature, and, like, but, you know, and magic. But she's had, like, depression, and she had a difficult childhood. She had a difficult life. Like, she I saw one thing where she was talking about how she woke up, she was at one point where she woke up every day and she expected her child to be dead. Yeah, she was like extremely depressed, and I think you can definitely see it in her work as well. You know, the struggles of young people, and it's certainly a reflection of her own childhood, and, you know, difficult family circumstances, and yeah, and then even towards the end, like, where she gives, spoiler alert, she gives, like, Harry a family in the end.
Yeah.
It's sort of, you know, realising that even through all that, she has come out the other end, and people can come out the other end of it.
That really makes me see Harry Potter in new life, yeah. We are coming to the end here, guys. Really enjoyed the chat.
Thanks so much.
We'll get back to just flying south. I was just looking at kind of a blurb on the website during the week, and three ideas were highlighted, and I thought it was a lovely kind of just very symbolic of what Flying South is all about. Community, respect and understanding. Why did you underline those ideas?
That's just some that wasn't something all the sort of posters and some and the marketing stuff, and that wasn't before the event. That was something that I saw during the event, so that was just reflecting what I'd seen, and that had sort of overwhelmed me and really influenced me. So that's something that really comes across when you're at the event. People are very respectful, very understanding, and there's a real sense of community, and that's just
I suppose that's not really highlighted in other open mic events. Like, it's just more about the performers and the poetry and stuff like that. So I think it's kind of getting across it's a community as well as an open mic event.
Lovely. Okay, Flying South, last Friday of every month in Jaja Studios in Stony Batter. What is your Twitter, Facebook, contact details?
Flying South Dublin on Facebook, and at Flying South Bird on Twitter. Yeah. And you can contact us at flyingsouthdublin@gmail.com.
Excellent. Oran and Shannon, thank you very much
for
coming
to
the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Stick around after the break, guys. We've got Daniel Wade coming in to chat to us about his career to date. And you're very welcome back to Writer's Block with me, Morgan O'Reilly, right here on 90.3 Near FM. Well, it's after 4 o'clock, and that can only mean one thing. We have been joined in studio by a living, breathing, real-life writer. Daniel, you're very welcome to the studio.
How are you doing, Morgan? Thanks for having me.
Very cool introduction. But let's keep it up. Let's keep it going. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You work in the studio, and where you're from?
I'm a 23-year-old graduate of IEDT in Dunleary. I've been writing for most of my life, since I was a kid, and throughout for the last decade, really, my energies have been geared mainly towards poetry, though I do try to write in various other mediums, prose fiction, journalism and radio drama.
Okay, we'll come back to those in a bit. Back to your childhood. You said you've been writing since you were a kid. Can you remember what age?
Well, I wrote my first story when I was like 8 years old, and it was a pirate story, you know, it was a complete rip-off of Treasure Island. It just changed. Just called myself Captain Dan, you know, the hero was called Captain Dan. And,
of course, roguishly handsome.
And, oh, of course, flowing red hair, you know.
Was there anybody who pushed you towards writing? Do you come from a family that has a lot of books? Or?
No, actually, I came more from a family that loves music. You know, but I was always encouraged to read. My mother's a teacher, for example. And I was always encouraged to read and to write and to pursue that. That was so I was fairly lucky in that regard. And when I was younger, I had a mentor in the form of Dermot Healy, the writer who died about a year ago. And that was a privilege to have. He was just a friend of my dad's and a friend of.
Excellent.
And he was just great. He was a real. He encouraged me to write.
Brilliant.
And here I am. I started writing poetry, and I think seriously when I was 15. Of course, at the time it was just rip-offs of various heavy metal lyrics at the time, and you know, as can often be the case. And then, you know, I gradually start realise actually I have to start reading more, because I went through a period where I stopped reading entirely in my early teens, and why I can't remember, but I just did. And I realised, well, if I'm going to be a writer, I kind of need to start reading more, you know, and read everything, not just what's prescribed to me in school.
You said that you started writing poetry seriously when you're 15. What do you mean by seriously?
There was a woman involved.
okay. Say no more.
It was a girl. I wanted to impress a girl, so I, you know. So I said about Roy. I mean, it was rubbish. You know, it's probably no wonder she turned me down.
Well, my heart bleeds. I'm sure every man listening, his heart bleeding too. So you're 23 years old. You're a young man. What does your age mean to you for writing? I mean, do you think of it or do you just write?
I just write. I mean, it's kind of been a part of my life so much now, which I'm just used to it, you know. But people seem to, I say I'm 23, and people get quite surprised by that, and I don't know why, but it's I think it's probably just I seem older than I am or something, or people think I'm older than I am, and I'm not. I still act like an idiotic teenager half the time anyway. My closest friends will attest.
Isn't the Blink-182 song What's My Age Again?
Don't even mention them in my
I think the protagonist in that song says 23, so just okay, well,
moving swiftly on.
You said poetry is your favourite form, but you also mentioned that you're trying to write, or do you try to write in other forms, or do you just you find yourself looking for a break?
Yeah, with me, I've written short stories. My confidence in my prose fiction, for example, I wouldn't have a great deal of confidence in it as of yet. I'm still working on it, but I am trying at it, and I've written plays, and I've written radio plays in particular, and I enjoy that a lot more, more because it's about language as much as anything else, and about hearing it, as you know, and hearing the effect of language on the ear, you know.
For poetry or for the plays or for the radio?
Both. Okay. I mean, even here when you're reading it out with the spoken word, I mean, it's a different experience to reading it on the page.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, in terms of confidence, I mean, you said you didn't have as much confidence in your prose writing. Is that from reading it yourself, or do you give it to other people to say?
It's more from reading it myself, and because my energies, as I said, have been so focused on the poetry for I think at this point the best part of nearly a decade, I've been very, or even 8 years now, that was just what I was focused on for so long, so I'm still very much in that mode, but I want to branch out, as it were, you know. So here I am just working away, as they say, you know.
I suppose to me there's always a difference between what you write and what you would like to see yourself writing. So say in 5 years down the road, I mean,
I wouldn't mind working in journalism. I wouldn't mind if I was so able. I mean, I've yet to pick up my degree yet as we speak, but I wouldn't mind working as a researcher or even if I made money off this game ball, but you know, that's got to be realistic.
unfortunately,
but I have the I'd love to just work, as I say, just work in any medium as long as it's in the service of language.
You know? In the service of language, nicely put. Radio drama. I know it's something that you're particularly interested, both from our chat here and from chatting with you in previous correspondences. What about that particular form appeals to you?
I'm not sure. I think it's because, as I said as well, it's the language. You know, I can really go to town on dialogue, and you know, and hearing the actors talk, and that's fantastic. But there's also the, I suppose, you can insert a sound effect in there, but it's really down to the listener to imagine it themselves and use that faculty, and that's what I get out of radio plays. There's some brilliant ones like The Dreaming of Roger Casement, for example, by Patrick Mason. That went out on RTE, and that's about Roger Casement. It's a real cinematic piece of work, and it's wonderful. You can hear the kind of the ship coming in, you can hear him in his cell, you can hear you can just visualise all this stuff, and it's fantastic. And that's what I want to do when I write a radio play.
Yeah, lovely. It's a funny kind of form, like, cause the listener is, as you say, you can hear him in his cell, you can hear him on the boat, you can see him. So it's very empowering. I mean, you get the imagination, but you're also slave to the radio in a sense.
Well, in the similar sense, I suppose, if you're reading a great novel, say, or even a particularly vivid poem, and certain poets I know have very visual eyes, you know, like Derek Walcott, for example, Lorca, or even Sylvia Plath, and they've got very strong visual sense, and if you read their work, you can almost see it yourself in your own mind's eye. And with radio, and even with reading a great novel, the best storytellers, I'm sure you'd agree, can really put you in the center of the scene and what's happening, and that's something really that the reader has to do themselves, you know. But it's only if the rider, if the riding is of any use as well, that, that will impel it.
You mentioned Walcott there. You mentioned ripping off metal lyrics when you were 15 earlier.
Walcott made me sophisticated.
You've graduated from Walcott.
You read Walcott's work and you just think, fuck, I wish it was that good. You know, it's like...
Yeah, no, I'm not hugely familiar with Walcott, I have to admit. I'd be more in tune with my Irish poetry and some of the classics and stuff. But as far as we're talking about you, was there anyone you were trying to imitate? I'm thinking of primarily of poets here, Irish poets, international poets.
I think the first poet, I suppose, being in Ireland, who else are you going to imitate except Yeats? Because we grow up in Yeats's shadow, and of course Yeats is a genius with language. He's some absolutely majestic lines. And then you branch out more, you read more, and I think Walcott, certainly in my late teens, would have been my, and to a large degree, my inspirational anchor, if you like. And then he certainly kind of compelled me to use language with full gusto, you know. And then I think briefly in my first year in college I would have Dylan Thomas, and now it would have been, and Dermot Healy of course was always overseeing it, if you like. And then
did Healy give you poets to read this guy, check this guy out?
He didn't really, no. He more just made me realise that this is a very serious vocation, and if I'm to be any good at it or of any use with it, I have to really dedicate myself to it. I can't just dip in and out casually if I'm to be any use. And he never actually explicitly said that to me, but that was something I just realised just from talking to him.
Okay.
You know, he wasn't really one to preach. He was wise enough not to make your own mistakes first.
And
you know?
When you say dedicate yourself, I mean, what does that involve?
Just that you need to make the time, and I suppose it's the same for me as would be the same for, say, a boxer. The best boxers always just spend hours with the burlap sack, and then for me it was just sitting at the laptop just kind of slaving away and, you know, sweating it out, and that meant having to give up time with your mates or whatever. Just have to pull all that aside, because right now the writing's important. And I won't deny there have been some, I've had some serious rails about all that happening in my life before, but you know, that's kind of the necessary strain.
So it's something that you do. You have to take very seriously.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that's like that every day. There are days I wake up and just, oh, fuck, I have to do more of this again. You know, and you think, well, actually, yeah, because if it was easy, would it even be worthwhile? Probably not.
If it was easy, anybody could do it. Yeah.
Well, it's Homer Simpson. If something's hard, it's not worth doing. You know?
yeah.
You know Homer Simpson. take the opposite view.
I take a lot of wisdom off Homer. Yeah.
Join
so,
the club.
What's that thing? 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration.
Yeah.
So you subscribe to that one then?
Yeah. So running out of body sprays as we speak. But all the deodorants.
Yeah, a poor man. What about, you're also big into spoken word nights around Dublin. Is there a good scene out there for a young poet like yourself?
There would be. There's, I mean, I'm fairly, I wouldn't be an authority on it, I'd say, but I am very much, I do enjoy it. I enjoy getting up on stage and I enjoy doing it, and it is very, and there are some very good poets working on the scene today. I mean, just throw a stone into the city itself and you'll find there's always a good night. There's like Sunflower Sessions in Neelands. There's the Irish Writer Centre have a few great ones.
Yeah.
There's Mixed Messages. There's the Circle Sessions, which I'm kind of involved in, and you meet some very powerful writers who as well are nothing like me, whose sentiments and whose leanings and whose mindset towards what poetry is and what language is completely opposed to mine, and they operate completely differently to me, and that's half the fun, because you're kind of going, well, everyone's kind of operating on a different keel, but again it's the service of language, but
fun but also helpful.
I mean, certainly more aware other people have their lives as well and are doing their thing, and you know, if they're all like me, it'd be very boring.
One thing though, I mean, you were talking about the community there, and it sounds great. It certainly, I agree with you. So it's probably a cliche that they people use of Irish people that were all poets and storytellers and saints and whatever. But yeah, there is like a wonderful kind of artistic, vibrant life around Dublin. But at the same time, like, poetry has a small audience. I mean,
it does, yeah, very much so.
You could meet a guy down the road and he'd read a book a week, but he never picks up a book of poems.
Yeah, and I think as well, in that case, it might be that, I mean, I can't speak for everyone. I mean, I always had the enthusiasm for it anyway, nothing really dampened it, but there was, I suppose, poetry does, it has a very, it's a very loaded word, poetry, you know, it's very, there's a lot of preconceptions about it, I think, and I don't know. I think people when you say you're, I used to remember when I started college, I'd be going to parties with mates, and a friend of mine introduced me to someone, and they'd say, "This is my friend Dan. He's a poet." And I kind of bristle a little bit, you know, just because you know that's a, you know, if they were to say, "This is my friend Dan. He's an engineer, or he's a mechanic, or he's a bricklayer," you know, it wouldn't matter because that's what I do. But with poets, it's a very, I don't know. It's the word. I think the word itself is just has a lot of baggage to it.
Do you think? Have you learned to live with that baggage, or?
Got no choice, really.
Okay. Good answer. Good answer. Well, you've got a huge collection of poetry, and you've actually brought some in with you today. And I've always said it. There's nothing like hearing a poem read in the poet's voice. So we're going to turn it over to you now. Okay. If you'd like to just maybe introduce the first poem that you're going to read for us.
This one's called After the Bailey, and it's written in memory of Jerry Conlon of the Guildford Four, who died around this time last year, would have been the 21st of June. And this is more about after he got out of prison. After the Bailey. In memoriam, Jerry Conlon, 1954, 2014. After the Bailey, he walked the streets at sundown, inhaling death like a coal fume, his face bristly, boots scuffed to shreds, clutching a life he knew he'd never resume. Dawn smiled sadly on the Falls Road. He heard a drunk's red raw laughter, worn out from dancing to the music of the spheres, the calm of hereafter, the sprawl of a city in guarded remission. For all things, he felt he stood accused. He had to remind himself that in prison, the sun and the moon are easily confused. The past is another country, they say, one he would never emigrate from. The last sound he needed to hear was the fateful echo of his own name, chanted by protesters, by prison guards, or declared at the pleasure of a judge as one more public enemy, an iron verdict, overseen from the altitudes of privilege. He pushed invisible rocks from street to street, stooping against a bulk only he could feel, his nerve centre scorched by trauma's molten milk. Another day to endure, Jerry Conlon. The sun rises for your trampled benefit, warming the blameless in a world where fortune favours only the well-connected.
After the Bailey by Daniel Wade. Lovely stuff. Talking about loaded words, Jerry Conlon and the Guildford Four.
Yeah.
Don't get much more loaded than that. What prompted this poem?
Just hearing about hearing about his death, for one thing. I suppose on Facebook, I mean, you want to, just don't want to read a newspaper anymore, just go on Facebook.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. But all joking aside, I read about him dying, and I'd never actually seen In the Name of the Father, and I still haven't actually, but I knew about the Guildford Four and all that, and I was listening to this radio interview with him he gave that was just played back, obviously, in light of his death, and wherein he mentioned that after he got out of prison, obviously he went on to become a real activist for people who were wrongly incarcerated, but he ended up, before that, he went through a terrible time himself, just depression and drugs and all sorts of chaos in wake of what had happened, and he said something about, in this interview, about not being able to go outside in the daytime because of, he just wasn't used to the cars and the trucks and the, you know, the bustle of the city. So he'd only go out at night, you know, when it was quiet, because that's what he was used to. And I remember thinking, that's a horrible way to to live and to feel and to feel to be in that place like that. If that if that's not distressing, I don't know what is. So and I felt you think you got it bad, Troy being that.
Yeah, there's no some lovely lines in that. Trauma's molten milk. You can't. I mean, you immediately think of mother's milk. You know, and as if the prison was the mother of his second life. You know, and then the past is another country. That's very Yeatsian. That's very Yeatsian. I find.
I forget who actually that original quote's from, because it is. It's in italics here, but I forget who it's actually who said it. But
okay, so excellent poem. We will move on to another poem if you're happy enough.
This one's a bit shorter.
Same again. Give us a little introduction if you would.
This one's called Adventure. That's a love poem. Her kisses clasp and clinch, her molten appetite swirling through the rush of give or take. She cups the heart she flared in plain sight of the ice-capped arrow, the hammer's hot shriek drumming through spinal cord and earlobe. The stars are banked in afterglow. Rain falls watchfully, and snow swarms wildly, as if caged in a globe. Until she belongs more to memory than to me. Should you ever ask why I let her leave, allowing exaltation to be cut so easily off, I'll answer, I never had her courage for life, nor her adventurous zeal for the mess of love.
Adventure by Daniel Wade. Lovely stuff again. It strikes me as a poem of contrasts. Am I right? You know, it's got clasp and clinch, give and take, an ice-capped arrow, a hammer's hot shriek. And then, I mean, of course, at its heart of it, it's boy-girl, you know, another contrast.
Well, I suppose it's about... certainly that this has been a problem in my life. I'm not a... when you're unable to communicate with the ones you care about, you know, and you're unable to kind of, I suppose, fully commit to something or fully commit to what love is or because it is frightening. I think people don't really want to admit it, but love is frightening. It's a very big thing. It's a very, much like the poetry, really, it does demand a lot of you, and it's not like in the movies where it's all violins breaking out at the crucial moment. It's kind of it takes work and it takes effort and it does hurt, and for both parties. And I think just some people are able to fall and fall hard, and that's just their natural state. Others are more reluctant, and it can be very, you know.
Would you write many love poems?
I used to. I used to. I think I scared them all off, but.
the mess of love.
I think in some ways people are probably a bit afraid of being human as well. Because I've read a lot about people saying no one wants to be the more interested party. I don't know if that's a human thing or if that's something we get in the 21st century. Or no one wants to actually be the one who cares more, because the one who cares less has all the power. It's depressing.
It's a leap of faith.
That's a very depressing thought to have. And I don't really want to believe it, but I've been wrong about a lot of things in my time. So
yeah, we'll move on with the poetry anyway.
It's good.
You're going to give us another one. You've got a fine collection of poems in front of you. Your corpus, as you call it.
Yeah, corpus. How can you tell I'm a pretentious dude, like, you know? Okay, well, trying to keep the short ones in there, so I don't write a lot of very long ones, to the consternation of many. But this one's for two friends of mine, Tony Floyd Canah and another friend of mine, Andy Murphy, and they're both two songwriters who I know from around. And they're both very good. They write their own stuff, and this is kind of a tribute to them. It's called Irish Maid. Tony Floyd Canah, I put my heart in a box, and Andy Murphy, this plastic paradise has melted now. Saunter onto the stage, strap on their guitars, plug in the amps, and between them strum several hundred chords of slightly distorted rhythm and blues. The PA flanks them in 100-watt backline. The mic stands in force. Fullbacks crouch at their feet. Speakers pulse heavily under the bass, echoing through Darkie Kelly's on Fishamble Street, near the western rim of Temple Bar. It's a night for the pearly half moon to bob and weave over Dublin's neon forest, and like frayed duffel bags bulging with tools, the clouds are loaded sourly with rain. The Liffey tilts in opaque motion, axles of blurred light hurtling in the swells. A flame in the airless throat glows on the air beneath worn posters advertising gigs in town, burning hourly with the clockwork season. Should water ever flow with the thickness of blood, then the city's brickwork arteries, this webbed morass of streets eroded by generations of footfalls, may soften to swill. But that's an ordeal for another night. Dublin is a keystone cut clean in half by the river's flinted arm, busker-ridden, traffic-hollowed, neon-blind, where the rooftops, once crowned in brewery smoke, now have the music swirl about their turrets, songs grinded out by fingers nimble as the inflamed dusk, here in the main bar of Darky Kelly's, to celebrate an end-of-year showcase in midwinter. A guitar riff throbs red raw. From Loughlinstown to Fish Amble Street, the roar of electric blue swims to the rafters while we knock back craft beer under a window silvery with body heat. A weekly break for freedom, I'd call it, a corrosion of the daily shackles that clench our lives in forlorn abeyance. The hour late, loose and unmanned, the first night song of the night underway, and the lazy smoulder of candles seething on every tabletop, warming us to the bone, evicting the chill, renegade music to renegade ears.
Lovely evocation of Dublin there. Works. Lovely one, yeah. I hadn't heard that one before.
Well, I wrote that one back in January, thereabouts.
Okay, so recent. Excellent. Unfortunately, time is creeping up on us now. It always goes quick on us. So before we get one more from Daniel, folks, Daniel, just tell us, you're not on Twitter, but you have SoundCloud.
I have SoundCloud. I'm SoundCloud at Daniel Wade 8. I've got a podcast on my radio play, The Outer Darkness, that's up on Dublin South Theatre Radio. You can find that. That's on podcast, just Google it. And I can be contacted at danielpwade@gmail.com, and I'm on Facebook if anyone wants to.
All of Daniel's, of course, we should mention all of Daniel's podcasts and radio plays and everything will be up on Twitter later for Writer's Block. But folks, that's all we've had time for today. We'll be back in 2 weeks. That is the 17th of July with another edition of Writer's Block. My colleague Joe Collins will be with you next week. As always, if you'd like to contact the show, you can get me email morgan_O'Reilly@live.com, or you can catch us on Twitter where all the podcasts, information and stuff of import will be up. That's @morgan_O'Reilly. I'd like to thank my guest Daniel Wade very much for coming in today, and he's going to leave us out with a poem. Thanks, folks.
Colossi. When the winding sheet of history coils stiffly around handrail and chimney stack, I'll be reminded it's no longer enough to write poetry, to build monuments from toothed stanzas to the splintering ego or the first vinegary taste of love. It will recall itself, the bruised brickwork, election posters slung to every lamppost, grimacing TDs, slogans promising national reform dotted strategically all over Dublin, flakes of Arctic light, a needle's sweet-toothed glint lie trampled beneath a car tyre, fan lights crown the ascendant doors that I have passed in late-night bewilderment, every footstep its own keepsake. But for now, I move with a scavenger's subtlety. Ignoring the chained, sneering neon, panic-stricken cars, omnivorous-eyed drunks swigging cans on a boardwalk bench, wastewater quenching the tumid Liffey below. It's a world apart, the volta of urban fever clotted on wrought-iron railings, college green bruised by rain, by rainfall's acid cleaver, statues joisted like deadpan colossi. Goldsmith, eyes fixed on a book, Burke in picture-perfect solemnity, and Grattan, posing with imperious bravado against the capital's daily rage, a bastion of multiplicity now, of manifold strangers. All of this and more, from the hard man I pretend to be, to the anxious boy I remain, trying to know these streets better than any map or sat-nav, cutting through shortcut and laneway, hard-earned wisdom advising me to keep the head down. This century's first exhausted decade is over. The city's motto and its Latinized hauteur mean nothing now. And all that's left, the blindness of rivers, fan lights, glinting needles, the sneer of neon, ascendant doors, brickwork, laneways, chimney stacks, rain, opudentia, civium, urbis, felicitas, this splintering stanza, fog, darkness.